Hello, everyone. I am John McDonald. I am very loud, so I'm going to turn myself down just a little bit. There we go. I am John McDonald, and I'm here with my lovely, fabulous co-host, Magnus. Hello, Magnus.
Hello. How are we today?
We're doing well. It's getting chilly every day here, and we're having a good time, and I'm having thoughts about what we're going to be doing in the lead up to the other gay Christmas, which is Christmas, I guess, for all intents and purposes. I thought it would be fun in November to discuss films with a large cultural impact. So the next couple of films we talk about specifically, it's not just going to be about the film themselves, and I would wager, especially for this film, it's not even so much anymore about it is about the film itself. There are some things I'd like to share, but Disney has released a DVD of this film with new features almost every year since 2006. So by this point, a lot of its backstory is going to be relatively well known. A lot of its culture is rather ubiquitous. But I do think there's a lot still to be told about The Nightmare Before Christmas. So I think we should talk about it because it's kind of the perfect movie after Halloween, but before Christmas. Actually, it's one of the perfect movies year-round for me, for a couple of reasons. But how did you feel when I was like, let's talk about Nightmare?
I thought it was a very perfect topic to discuss. It's a fantastic movie for the twilight of Halloween and the dawn of Christmas. It's almost a movie that stands by itself in its own little subgenre, because I struggle to think of any other movies that have ever been sort of could easily be classed as either a Halloween or a Christmas movie.
And I'm not surprised you like it as much as you do too, because you're very, especially being from the UK, you're very well versed in pantos. And so something with a traditional three-act operatic structure like Nightmare purposely has is something that is not just familiar, but it becomes more delightful because you have like the text of this is based heavily in traditions I'm very familiar with, which is super cool.
Delightful, what a great word. I think there's something to be said about saying that Nightmare Before Christmas is very delightful in itself. Like, there's a real energetic buzz that goes throughout this movie. You know, it has some like ghoulishly ghoul parts, of course, because it's semi-Halloween, but it's almost like the perfect blend between Halloween spookiness and Christmas sugariness, you could say.
And this was Tim Burton's passion project too. A lot of the people he met while he was working on Batman's Return, which is why he didn't direct this, Paul Rubens, who he had worked with on Pee-wee's Big Adventure, is in this. Tim Burton at this point in the early 90s is about as famous as Ryan Murphy is now, except Tim Burton can actually finish the story and doesn't cross picket lines, which I have lots of feelings about. But so in his like canon of movies, this was both his third movie featuring a Christmas narrative, but it was also really his third kind of cult sleeper hit, because Batman Returns was pretty big, but then they handed the reins over to Joel Schumacher. And of course we did an episode on Beetlejuice where I talked a bit about Tim Burton's history. And so if you look at it in like Tim Burton canon, it's still pretty early. His style is very unique, and he'd been essentially pitching it to Disney since he'd started working for them in like the early 80s or something like that. So what's interesting is that this was the movie he kept coming back to wanting to make, and it kind of shows. And I think that's why it didn't just become a cult hit, but it also became like a cultural phenomenon that lives pretty well to this day.
Yes, it's definitely one of those films that you see quite frequently because of the fact they rerun it quite often. I believe that you mentioned that it's one of the ones that come on quite annually around Thanksgiving for...
Well, I mean, you pop the DVD in. In 2006, 2007, when they started releasing DVDs, they also did start releasing it in movie theaters. Like as a one-off, one-night engagement. The Hollywood Bowl and the concert stuff didn't start until about 2010.
Yes.
But now that's so ubiquitous that people think of it as an annual event. And interestingly enough, the first year that it really took off when it came kind of not out of obscurity, but when it started becoming more mainstream, was in 2001. And it took about 5 years because 2001 was the first year the Haunted Mansion in Disneyland got taken over by Jack Skellington, and they started doing the Nightmare Haunted Mansion, which I think as an overlay and an update to the ride is incredibly unique and as good as the classic Haunted Mansion. I still think the best Haunted Mansion is probably the one in Disney World because it's slightly bigger and the concept is a little more archaic and a little more disorienting. But I think the one in Disneyland is very special, and I think the fact that Disneyland was the first one to have the Nightmare overlay before Jack Skellington was hosting Halloween parties, I think that had something to do with its re-release, because between 93 and 2000, it's like a Disney movie, but it's technically from their adult imprint Touchstone. So it's not an animated feature in a traditional sense. It is, but it's not.
Yes.
Everything about it is non-traditional, essentially.
Yes, you're completely right. Before I move on to that, the one comment I was going to make in relation to, we were just talking about it being sort of an annual tradition with Thanksgiving now. I was going to say, it's very much one of those films that word of mouth, and it's something that people know of and they show each other. And thus it spreads quite naturally, in a sense, because of the fact it has such a solid identity of its own.
It
ends up standing out so well. You mentioned Touchstone Pictures. That's fantastic. That's literally what I was on the same mindset to mention. Because this has always been a Disney property. And it kind of feels weird saying that, because Nightmare is quite different to a lot of other animation that Disney traditionally did. So I could see why, dare I say, they kept it, but they gave it to sort of like a sister production company rather than Disney Animation.
So here's something interesting I learned from the Wikipedia page that dovetails into my interest in Disney. So in the era this was getting made at, Jeffrey Katzenberger was in charge. And he and Michael Eisner were off and on kind of the golden children that revitalized Disney animation. This was Jeffrey Katzenberger's, partially his idea, because they still owned the rights to it. And Henry Selick was still an animator after Tim Burton was fired. That's what it seems like in the story. But it was the success of Who Framed Roger Rabbit and merging technology with animation that was the reason Jeffrey Katzenberger went after Nightmare so hard. And when they didn't want to have it be in the traditional animation oeuvre, they moved it to Touchstone just so it would still be released. So when you think about this film, because we have more claymation than ever because we have studios like Laika, but in 93, the only big claymation thing happening was my beloved Will Vinton and his like claymation Christmas thing that you saw with the California Raisins every year. So much like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, this is really about showing off technology and merging technology and film and audience. And I feel like even though Who Framed Roger Rabbit doesn't have as big a presence in the park, doesn't have as big a cult following, I'd argue you can see a lot of those same elements. Except, of course, Nightmare didn't drive poor Bob Hoskins to the brink of insanity. But that is for our Who Framed Roger Rabbit episode. So something interesting about this film to keep in mind is that it's not just a good animated film. It's about the technique of stop motion animation, which it took 3 years to make it. So once you're in the once you're in it in about like year one, at the end of year one, it's kind of a sunk cost at that point, because it takes like a lot of energy to make a stop motion. So like, this was 3 years of a lot of people's lives to hope it did well. And it was a sleeper hit, and it was called a cult film, but it didn't like garner the same amount of money Lion King would garner. And in fact, looking over like the JCPenney catalog, where a lot of Disney merchandise got made into like sleeping bags and tents and toys, even though like they were very on the uptake, JCPenney didn't do any merchandise for Nightmare. We don't really start seeing merchandise until Disney embraces it in 2001, and then Hot Topic starts producing stuff, really. Everything else would have to have been fan made up to that point. But yeah, something about this movie inspires people to love it. I do think it has to do with technology and with the fact that it's spiritually an opera. I think it also has to do with how much everybody loves Catherine O'Hara and Danny Elfman. No matter how much Family Guy likes to dunk on Danny Elfman, Danny Elfman is still more creative and more popular than Seth MacFarlane will ever be. And I think that must nod him a little bit, because the jokes he makes at Danny Elfman's expense, I just feel are unwarranted. But that is just my feeling on the matter. So.
I wonder if it's something to do as well with the very sincere acting and characters within the film. Because there's quite a, you really do get invested within Jack's newfound enthusiasm for Christmas. He's clearly someone that's been struggling to find sort of something to ignite his creative and like inquisitive nature again. And he comes, stumbles upon this, and it's sort of a universal thing that finding something new as a new passion project. So I wonder whether that's partially why people get quite invested within the story.
It is different. Yeah. No, go ahead. Yeah, finish your thought.
I was just gonna say as well, it's both a very straightforward three act opera, musical, play, etc. But also at the same time, it's one of those things where the more you watch it, all the little subtle details that are included within it sort of come to the forefront more.
Yeah.
And I believe that's why it's great as a rewatchable classic. And it's something that even if you watched it many times before, occasionally you get the desire to go back and see it again.
I think something interesting to think about in relation to that is the idea is that Jack is a non-conventional hero for Disney, not just in being a bit more eccentric, a bit more goth, a bit more, you know, Hades-like, but also he starts out the movie having everything and he loses it. Like, if you think about Ariel, if you think about Simba, if you think about Cody from Rescuers or Oliver, in the time period in 93, at this what people call the kind of the golden age of Disney, as opposed to the era we're in, which is like post-Disney Renaissance. There's not really a hero in Disney canon. There are more princesses that are much like Sally than there are heroes like Jack. I actually haven't got a chance to read it, but they are making a sequel to Long Live the Pumpkin Queen, which is the novels that revolve around Sally. After the movie ends, it came out just recently, and they're making a sequel to Long Live That. But I can find it easy to do that because Sally is much more of a traditional Disney character in a way. Not Catherine O'Hara doesn't just do that wistfulness in her voice very well. She does. She's always done that well. But Sally is the one that goes unheard through most of the movie. She has a touch of psychic ability, which is very unique for this film, but doesn't interrupt the flow of the film.
No.
She basically spends her the entire movie like Cinderella in the last 10 minutes after the evil stepmom has locked her in the tower and she's trying to get out. Yeah, there's something interesting about the idea that this really does flip the Disney story on its head, and they were so forget about it, they released it on the same platform that they released Splash on as like an adult film. Yeah, I really do. I love how people have embraced Nightmare. It's the same kind of crowd, but bigger, that embraces like Addams Family, both the 60s black and white TV show and the 90s films. There's a really great element of other people that love Pee Wee's Playhouse and Paul Reubens have something to hang their hat on, not just because of the character, but because of the architecture. Film buffs love it because of the nods to like German Expressionism and Frankenstein and Cabinet Dr. Caligari. So there's something in it to love, even for in the Wikipedia page, actually, someone mentions the Grinch gets mentioned a couple times. The idea of Zero being like Max, the idea of going on this journey, the idea of a fantasy town. So really, there's a culture of it that is so much more than the movie. Like, the movie is good, but it's after you see the movie when everything really starts happening. So,
yes, I would almost argue there's a parallel between Nightmare Before Christmas and Rocky Horror in terms of something that came out, was a sleeper hit, and achieved quite a high level of cultural saturation to the point that the culture and the built around it sort of is bigger than the actual production itself, because you got people dressing up in costume regularly, going to repeat performances and for Rocky, and it's sort of similar to people that, you know, go back to this film, rewatch again occasionally. And I have seen during this Halloween month, people sharing their cosplays of Sally and Jack and such. Not so many Oogie Boogies, but I suppose they don't want to be in a sackcloth of insects.
Well, yeah, it's also, there's kind of a bet. So this is an interesting thing about this movie too. There's a lot of back and forth surrounding it. The idea of, is it ever going to get a sequel, which the video games are supposed to be. The idea of, is Oogie Boogie a racist character, which the person that voiced it and danced for the character did not have a problem with it, but some people say it is. There are these urban legends that spring up around it. The idea that all the characters in Halloween Town are based upon people that like died. The idea that you can watch Corpse Bride and Frankenweenie and Nightmare in a certain order, and it's like the backwards telling of Jack's life, which has been disproven. It's really fun to see all the people like go with the story. In fact, people love it so much that they got Patrick Stewart for like one of the newer DVD releases to record the epilogue and the prologue. They did a whole separate CD called Nightmare Revisited, where like Amy Lee from Evanescence like recorded a song on it.
Oh wow. So
yeah, people are still, I think it's that Amy Lee. I don't know what other Amy Lee would be. But
I think it would still probably be that one.
Yeah. People are still participating in the life of this movie. And I find it interesting that Tim Burton is protective, but he loves the celebration. Like, as much as people love Edward Scissorhands, and as much as I love his version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the Hollywood Bowl is not putting on annual Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Ed Wood, Beetlejuice, like, fully, like, standing room only. You can't get tickets to it unless you, like, sacrifice your firstborn. The Hollywood Bowl has been doing this annual thing for, like, 5-6 years now. People go to it dressed up. I know a guy that did Jack Skellington. He literally taught himself to walk in stilts so he could be the appropriate height for the character. I think Nightmare 2, the songs for Nightmare Before Christmas are some of the ones that you often see repeated when people like light up their house for Halloween and they set it to music. But I will also say, what's this about Christmas Town? Would be a fantastic Christmas carol as well, especially if you're in a neighborhood where a lot of people like jazz up their homes for Christmas.
Yes, you're right. When it comes to going to social media, when people are sharing stories and reels and what have you, I have noticed a fair number of them using Nightmare Before Christmas tracks in the backgrounds for them, along almost with the same prevalence that they'll use Hocus Pocus and some of the horror movie theme songs and such.
I've started seeing more Dracula, so I do love seeing someone using Rob Zombie and blasting it across their neighborhood. I do appreciate that.
Yes. Oh. So I did want to mention about one of my favorite themes of this movie, if we have a moment to discuss it.
I think we do. Yeah, definitely.
I quite like the aspect of identity within this film. Jack being sort of at a, as you say, Jack has everything, but he feels a bit of a lost, a loose end with himself, and then stumbling upon something that reignites his passion again, and in a sense being willing to adopt a new identity because of his enthusiasm. Sally as well, like she's not trying to find an identity per se, but you know she's still focused upon it as well.
I would say she's trying to find identity. She's trying to get out of the shadow of the person that built her. She's
Yes.
constant. It's played for laughs, but it's actually kind of a sad story of Sally trying desperately to be free. And
Yes.
in a way, Jack's boredom and her. There's a reason that their love story is a major cornerstone of the trailer from '93 for this film. That's how they pitched it, was like a weird love story almost.
Yes. And then it kind of extends further, more into an overarching thing about the identities of both Halloween and Christmas as celebrations, and what happens when they almost meet and start to both merge and clash with each other. The way that the town residents in Halloween Town try to understand what the identity of Christmas is, but they're using their own experiences in order to try and understand that. It doesn't quite work out, so to
Yeah.
speak.
I would actually like to read you a quote from Tim Burton about this film,
Ooh.
from the Wikipedia page. Anytime there was Christmas or Halloween, it was great. It gave you some sort of texture all of a sudden that wasn't there before. And so this is Burton talking about solitude, living in Burbank, but not really fitting in, talking about his love for Vincent Price, which anyone that loves Vincent Price knows as the years go by. People really only love Bill Hader's Vincent Price, like, I have to sit him down to show a movie. So there's something about Tim Burton's life, his loneliness. I think you see it a bit with Edward Scissorhands, but because Edward Scissorhands as a movie is almost distracted by the bullying of Edward, and because Johnny Depp spends most of the movie as a mime, it could be really hard to see it. But I think there's a lot between, like, Jack and Edward, and maybe even Jack and Johnny Depp as Willy Wonka, about the idea of solitude, the idea of success, but not necessarily understanding that success will exact a price at some point. I don't know if that's exactly what happens with Jack. It doesn't feel like a cautionary tale. He's still a hero at the end. He still rescues Santa. I think the delusion of the town is really good. It's played straight. There's no tongue in cheek to it, which is something we get in Disney now. A lot of tongue in cheek things, like Frozen, basically dunking on Anna for wanting to marry Hans, even though she'd been locked up in her house for years on end without seeing anybody new. Everything in this movie is very sincere. It's not played for laughs. I do think the one problem with that sincerity is that in the middle of Act Two, the Making Christmas song, I think, is the only misstep. I don't mind the scene, but I think as far as songs go, the only song I really just don't care for very much is Making Christmas. I don't think it's a bad scene, but I think it drags the movie just a little bit right in the center of it, where it, right before it starts pepping up. I also do like the nod to Rudolph. And I think the very shorthand use of the Rudolph story, which basically was Macy's trying to sell Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer dolls, is pretty genius. But right before it is the Making Christmas song, which is the only part of the movie that drags for me at all. And that's just barely. That's a very small, like, criticism of, I would argue, great Americana stop-motion art. In the same vein as, like, Paranorman or Coraline. In fact, I could not believe that Coraline wasn't at all influenced by it. I mean, not the story, but like the way they do stop motion, the mix of materials, because clay does not mold perfectly. There's always indents, so you have to use like a plasticine. So I would heavily wager that if we talked about Coraline and Nightmare in a line, we'd see a lot of stuff that was similar, just based on the idea of outcasts and the idea of another world. I also love the Muppet Babies nod, because you don't see a lot of the adult faces and you just see like their bodies, which is totally, for me, a nod to the nanny character from Muppet Babies. And if that's unintentional, I'm just going to believe that was an intentional thing. And that Tim Burton also loved the classic animated series Muppet Babies.
Oh, sorry, having a bit of a mental throwback at the moment. I grew up with the original Muppet Babies when I was a wee nipper, so that's such a pleasant reminder. And I choose to believe he probably did make it an intentional homage. So many times I've noticed like very random out of place references to things in stuff that's very much not even like anywhere close to the same genre.
Yeah.
And it's those kind of little details or what if moments that you notice that you can really appreciate in films like this. You mentioned about Paranorman before, by the way. Excellent film. I really do need to rewatch it again at some point. It sort of surprised me like how much I enjoyed that one.
Well, just a quick aside to that. I was surprised by how much I enjoyed like Turning Red, which is a film that you talked me into seeing, because we did it for the podcast, and I was like, are you sure? It doesn't seem like it's for me, but Turning Red, Nightmare Before Christmas, I would argue Rescue Ridge Down Under, which not enough people have seen, is a movie not just for us, but for people to discover that it'll be for them. People that love political satire have a whole like mayor subplot in this movie. The idea that he's just an official of the town and he doesn't have any real power, and he's just an empty figurehead for the Pumpkin King. It's a very small thing, but every scene the mayor is in, he's like a bumbling character. They're not letting him in all the secrets. He falls down the stairs. He's very like, not inept, but it's very much a character that is the buffoonery of politicianism. So even political junkies have something to love in this movie. I mean, Santa is the ultimate authoritarian dictator, really, not in this film, but there have been plenty of people that have made that connection. So
I would almost argue the portrayal of the mayor within this film is more of just he's the administration, not necessarily with he's the mayor, but as you say, it's more of a figurehead administration, whilst Jack himself is the sort of center of authority and within the town, although Oogie's doing his best to undermine that.
Well, he's the one that people are drawn to. They actually did. It's either a video game or they did a story where they actually did a prequel where they show, like, how Jack won the crown of Pumpkin King. By the way, before I forget, in the James and Giant Peach, and this is one of those like rumor things that comes up every now and then, in James and the Giant Peach, there is a scene with like a ghost pirate ship under the water that James ends up under the water, like trying to find a compass at. That is a reused figure of Jack Skellington just in a pirate hat. So I don't think it's supposed to be continuity. It just so happened that Henry Selick directed them both, and they're both kind of stop motion. So they probably were just like, "Hey, we've got an extra Jack reclining laying around. Let's just use it." And people were really kind of carried away with that. Kind of like you can watch Frankenweenie, Corpse Bride, and Nightmare in the back order, and like watch Jack Skellington's life. It's been disproved. Both that and the rumor about all the characters being living in Halloween Town, how they died, has been disproven. I'm still inclined to believe a few of them, like Lock, Shock, and Barrel, might be true. But really, the idea that Sally was created in Halloween Town is supposedly the linchpin for why that doesn't work. But it's hard to say. I think if it has fun and it does no harm, I see no reason why people couldn't enjoy that theory. It certainly adds some context to the movie if you like the idea of that part of the story. So.
So we've mentioned that Halloween, that Night Before Christmas is for like people that often find themselves to be, shall we say, the other within general culture, like people that love stuff that's not necessarily like straightforward mainstream content and can find a real buzz out of this film. We mentioned about that, and a thought that really occurred to my mind is we mentioned about this film, you brought up Turning Red. And some other stuff like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I wonder, in a way, you could almost class, if you were to imagine the whole Disney library, as it were, you've got Disney Animation, Marvel now, etc. Those are the mainstream, and movies like Nightmare Before Christmas, they're the other population of the studio, so to speak.
Well, what's interesting, oh, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, for sure. Sorry.
The Night Before Christmas, Turning Red, etc. Because they're sort of a little bit out there and they're focused on very niche-y things at times. Although you can still very much, I think, appreciate them from a general perspective. They're like the other population of the Disney canon, as it were.
Yeah, and as Disney acquires more companies in their bid for world domination, they also acquired, it occurs to me now that as we're talking about it like that, they acquired 20th Century Fox at a certain point. So they had a whole bunch of people were making fun of. So I hate when people are like, "Ooh, Tim Curry's the Disney princess. Ooh, Cusco's the Disney princess," when neither of them identify as female. So please stop that. But one of the incidences of Disney buying all these properties is that they bought the Don Bluth Library. And so what's interesting is the idea that Jack Skellington and Nightmare really fits almost more in with a Don Bluth sensibility, because there's an Edward Gorey, Charles Adam angle to this. In All Dogs Go to Heaven, there's a reference to Boschian Hellscape, which is a really famous artistic version of hell, very personal. I think of Christopher Lloyd in Anastasia and the use of occult and magic in telling a love story. Specifically, so there's something about Nightmare Before Christmas not really fitting into Disney canon, even though it is Disney canon. Spiritually, it's much closer to a Don Bluth story in my mind, which isn't bad. The creepy, I would argue that it's actually less creepy than the creepy circus in We're Back a Dinosaur Story, where like people are like literally selling their soul to the ringmaster and he has like a magic bolt for an eye. There's something interesting about Nightmare, both as Disney canon that people embrace for the people that are a little more eccentric, but also where it does almost effortlessly challenge the status quo of what a Disney, because like Jack is not really Ariel, but in like the Kingdom Hearts game, Jack and Ariel are on par with each other because they're both people that come in to help Sora, Donald, and Goofy save their individual worlds, for better or for worse. The Jack Skellington levels are much easier than the Ariel levels because, like, never can get the hang of both fighting while swimming. but it's one of the few worlds that are both from that era celebrated easily across all the games.
And perhaps again that's to do like the inclusion of Nightmare in Kingdom Hearts alongside like the established Disney animated features. I think that both shows that they're on sort of like an equal footing, and the fact that Disney as well acknowledges the fact that Nightmare has such a cultural relevance that we can include this quirky film from 30 years ago, because it is the 30th anniversary of the film this year. We can include all these quirky characters and levels in Kingdom Hearts, and people will recognize it straight away. You know, well, it's not Disney, just some obscure property.
And Disney loves money. I mean, now that it's a big cultural phenomenon, they're like, oh yes, we're going to start making all the merchandise. But in 2001, it was a huge risk to overlay the beloved Haunted Mansion. I'm not sure where else they do it. I know the one, I believe the one in Tokyo is so different they wouldn't do an overlay there. Maybe they have. Paris might do the overlay. I'm not sure. I know Disney World. No, I'm 90% sure Disney World doesn't. I think their Haunted Mansion just doesn't ever change. But it is probably one of the most singularly remarkable things, except for like It's a Small World after all, the Christmas edition they do. I do think that Haunted Mansion, Disneyland, Nightmare Before the Haunted Mansion, I don't know what they actually call it. They kind of call it the Nightmare Takeover. But people love it so much, they actually book to go to Disneyland when it's open. It is nuts getting in the ride. You wait for hours, even if you like have like whatever the hell they're calling Fast Pass now. You get the smell of gingerbread because they actually have real gingerbread scent in there, like the gingerbread haunted house they have in the dining room table instead of the ghostly cake. Like, you get real smell of gingerbread. Sally replaces the bride at the end. The giant snake that eats the gifts is the giant snake that eats the gifts in the attic. So it's not quite a one-for-one movie, but it's pretty incredible what they do to the ride in a short turnaround too, because it's a massive change to the ride in a lot of ways. It's ambition, let me tell you.
And it does make complete sense, to be honest. You know, after all, Jack was leading Halloween Town in a takeover of Christmas, so why not a takeover of the Haunted Mansion to show them just how right they can do it?
Well, that's the thing, though, is that Haunted Mansion isn't just an institution. Haunted and Pirates of the Caribbean, before they started making the Pirates movies, were solely something dreamed up by Imagineers that didn't exist anywhere else in the world. It could have failed tremendously. Like, that's something interesting, too, that Haunted Mansion and Nightmare share, is that Haunted Mansion was actually showcasing a lot of illusion technology, and their Doom Buggies were the first kind of car they had. Also, the Haunted Mansion itself is a traditional three-act structure in story, but you move through it physically. So in a way, it's perfect in more ways than one. It's also good because it's a great balance of whimsy and terror, which I think Nightmare Before Christmas does really well. There are some parts of Nightmare Before Christmas that are incredibly scary, but then you get the silly parts, like there's a jazz band that just lives on a street corner and plays sad jazz songs the whole time. Lock, Shock, and Barrel just being like the ultimate demonic trick-or-treaters. It's a very Goosebumps thing, which I kind of love. They mentioned Dr. Seuss in the Wikipedia because of the buildings, but I do think the buildings are more German Expressionism, Eastern European cinema than Seuss, but I can understand the impetus to draw a line between Seuss and like Jack's weird turret house thing.
So there was one point I want to make that I was musing about, and I don't know how truthful this is to real life, but I'm going to put a little theory I have out there. So all of this that was going on, Night Before Christmas, the oh, what should we call it, the Haunted Mansion and things like that. I believe that was taking place around the same time that, yes, it was taking place during the tenure of Michael Eisner as Disney CEO. Now, something that Michael was really about was he wanted to make Disney hip again, not just for kids, but what he saw as the target audience for them would also be teenagers, to make Disney sort of hip and cool, to borrow some phrases.
There's some irony there because Disney really, I mean, as much as we love to think of it, there's a lot of ways in which it's not. But yes, understandable.
And I know that for many times, Michael was like using his own children, his son, to sort of gauge like if Disney was being successful and such. Now, this is where my theory crafting comes into play. It feels interesting to me that they, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas was quite kooky. It was a little bit different. It almost feels like it's a sort of thing that would be made, like pushed forward to appeal to an audience beyond sort of like to Disney's traditional demographics. And then as it became more of a sleeper hit that people were starting to take notice of, it's interesting that both they did a Haunted Mansion takeover, and then they looked at the Haunted Mansion and said to themselves, we could actually try and make a story out of this and give it its own film as well. Because there's a number of like similarities between Nightmare Before Christmas and the Haunted Mansion ride story, as it were,
Depending
being
upon which Haunted Mansion story you know, by the way,
well.
every Haunted Mansion park story is slightly different. Like you're the one in Paris is Wild West themed, which is nowhere in America, and that's one of the reasons I want to go to Disneyland Paris is so I can experience their dune buggy coffins and the underwater cavern. One of the main reasons.
Ooh, gave me plenty of notice, and maybe I'll try and be in your neck of the woods then, when if you ever come over to Europe.
Have plenty of notice.
So I just wonder whether, in a nutshell, some of this was Michael's attempts at, in different ways to create properties that were appealing outside of that kid's demographic to the wider sort of teen and young adult audience to get them hooked on Disney as a brand.
And I can see that. I mean, after all, Animal Kingdom was supposed to be like that, but it did fail a little bit outside of the projections. There's a couple really great documentaries about Disney around that time. Waking Sleeping Beauty is a standard, obviously. There was one I saw on Amazon Prime that was literally just about Michael Eisner's tenure in the parks and what rides succeeded, what rides didn't succeed. Like, there was going to be a Dick Tracy ride that end up becoming Roger Rabbit's spin ride, which I love Roger Rabbit's ride, so I'm not sad about it. One thing that's interesting to me is I think this Haunted Mansion overlay, no matter how long they've been planning it for, and the Food Network both share something in common. And this is going to be a little bit sad, but you have to bear with this. So Alton Brown in his Hot Ones interview talked about the fact that before September 11th, the Food Network channel was just a specialty channel, and people turned to the Food Network for comfort in the shadow of 9/11. And I don't know how much 9/11 affected the push of getting Haunted Mansion display down, But there is a period of time between the release of the film to the first DVD release, where right smack dab in the middle, the Haunted Mansion overlay at Disneyland falls into that. And I wonder if it's about comfort and nostalgia and a safe thrill as much as it is about anything else. Now, I don't know for sure. I've never talked to anyone. And I'm not even sure, because it must have taken a lot of planning for that first year to get done. And there were still some things they had to work out. But I can't help but think the idea of looking for magic and safety, two of the things that Disney has touted in providing for many years. Yes. By the way, when I say Disney is not cool, I don't mean that it's not a great brand in a lot of ways. I just mean the idea of Disney trying to always consistently be hip and cool is what leads to NSYNC and Five doing a dance battle in Orlando, which is not necessarily cool and timeless. Nothing against either NSYNC or Five. I do love When the Lights Go Out. But it's one of those things where when Disney often tries to be cool, they overreach. And they really kind of show off just how enamored they are with the idea of fairy tale and romance. And I just say, be who you are. The fairy tale and romance is something I love. I love Disney's verisimilitude. I love the idea that it's supposed to be a park where it's clean and you can do it as a family or you can do it solo. And if you get it, you get it. I do find it interesting that almost all the merchandise that I have for Nightmare was not bought at a Disney park. It was almost all bought in a mall at like a Hot Topic, or it was bought for me by someone buying it from like ThinkGeek when that was a thing. And so they do Haunted Mansion Jack Skellington merchandise now. I think they have Sally mini ears even. But for a long time, Disney was not really... Like, Disney was using Jack Skellington about on the same par as they were using Kermit, which was to say every now and then they pull it out to go, look, we own other things.
Yes.
Quite famously, they have not treated the Muppet brand with a lot of respect.
No.
And it's partially it's to keep Kermit out of Mickey's way, but partially it's also it also just hit at the same time when they were trying to figure out what rides to keep, which is why we don't have more Muppet stuff in the park.
Yeah.
But in a way, Jack is almost a great Halloween version of Mickey without all the baggage that like Pete has or Oswald. I can easily see why Skellington was chosen to almost always host the Halloween parties. Now it's like the Sanderson sisters do it and Judge Doom, which is a little weird.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize how like creepy the Sanderson sisters are in concept. Yeah, it's great when it's Bette Midler singing, but if you like take a step back from the Sanderson sisters, the concept is a little horrifying.
There are we considering how child friendly Disney always touted itself to be, you know, the parks are a magical place where children can come and have fun. Taking free child murdering witches. Because I remember the first film being shocked at the first time I watched it that they actually killed the little girl in the house.
Yes, it is quite a shocking. I was shocked it got made at all. But of course, it was originally supposed to be, it wasn't supposed to be a full feature. I think we talked about this in the Hocus Pocus episode when we did it. But there it's all kind of around the same time. And I do think now that they're considering doing a Hocus Pocus 3, for some reason, and however they're going to do it, you know, it'll be we'll start getting more Jack stuff too, just to compete.
You see, I wonder now. So, going back to what you're saying about merchandising and such, and Disney now being more comfortable with embracing its less traditional properties, and what I mean by that is like Disney always had like the magic of Disney. But them actually embracing gothic-y elements and witches as positive or at least neutral characters and other magic users as well, as not being sort of like the source of trouble. It didn't traditionally do that. So I wonder whether we're seeing a change we've seen a change over the past few decades since Nightmare came out on how Disney actually approaches and acknowledges these properties. It could be that they didn't release any merchandise at the time when Nightmare came out, because they just didn't think that that prop merchandise and that property would fit their brand in the Disney shop.
I'm surprised they didn't do anything for Zero, though. Maybe they did, and I just remember it because I was younger then. But Zero is kind of like the perfect companion ghost dog to go with, like the Oliver and Company cats and dogs. Yeah.
He is, well, he kind of is, but at the same time, he's still related to the Nightmare property. And it kind of took like a few decades and Disney then seeing, oh, wait a second, people really embrace these characters at all ages, and we actually want to be quite diverse. Yeah, let's bring them in. Let's put them alongside Minnie and Mickey, and like they can all get together for a big group piece of artwork, etc.
Yeah, what's interesting is Disney is always, I think we're coming to the point where we're going to start wrapping up, but Disney has always flirted with other and occult. So I'm thinking of the first Escape to Witch Mountain and then Return to Witch Mountain, the ones from like the 60s. And I'm thinking about Bedknobs and Broomsticks. I'm thinking of Witcher in the Woods. But those things don't really come with merchandise. Mostly because when they tried to remake Escape to Witch Mountain, it failed flat on its face, and not even The Rock could save it, because it just lacked the charm of the 60s version. I think something that they become more comfortable with, and something you saw from like Princess and the Frog on, was that they are more comfortable with magical elements they weren't doing before. And I think it's something in post-Renaissance, because they're trying to deconstruct and stay relevant. They're more willing to look at those darker paths, as long as there's like a redemption to them, and it's not just about that. But there's always been something about Disney, like the Alice in Wonderland ride. When it wants to be dark, Disney can be mischievous and dark. Yes. They just have to choose to embrace it.
I want to be slightly snarky here and go off on a small tangent very quickly. I wonder if Disney looked at the success of Harry Potter, for example, and all of a sudden a lot of kids being quite enthusiastic with the notion of being witches and wizards. And they looked at their properties and went, you know what? Why can't Elsa be a magical snow-wielding queen? Why can't we have an Asian girl turn into a panda? Or a wise old voodoo lady in the swamps that helps the princess, etc.?
I do think it had to do with the fact that Pixar was not originally a Disney company. It was people that were leaving Disney to do stuff. I think they looked not at Toy Story, which was one of the first Pixar films, but by the time we get to like Inside Out, tackling much darker, much harder, much more internal work people have to do, that they looked at how that was challenging and they said, you know, kids can take darker fairy tales a little bit. And it doesn't mean they need to remake Little Mermaid so, you know, she actually turns into seafoam bubbles like she does in the Kristen Anderson story. No. But there's a way in which, like, I'm thinking about Disney Plus not putting Meet the Torkelsons on, but adding in That's So Weird, which was sort of an urban legend show, a road show like Supernatural, but much younger. And the mom was like the head of a rock and roll group. So they were on a tour bus together, and it was a family thing. But there's always been a part of Disney that has flirted with the occult. Touchstone quite famously did the Ray Bradbury story with the Demon Circus and the, and the spiders on the face that only can be destroyed by lightning, which I think about all the time. So it's an interesting dichotomy that in Nightmare Before Christmas, I think you can see it embracing, because it's a lighter version of that. And I think that's about as far mainstream into the darkness as they're probably willing to go. Because even Kingdom Hearts pulls back from it quite a bit. So
I will say I have a great example how they've embraced it recently, and how they probably purified it into the light, as you might have said. Encanto, the miracle, and the fact that they refer to their gifts and their magic, and the fact that the magic is running out, etc. But it's seen as quite a beneficial, and like, you know, the whole thing with the family trauma, which is another thing of, like you were saying about Disney willing to look at like more heavy issues within its films. The family generational trauma thing, it was quite a nice depth to narrative. Especially if you rewatch it a couple of times, you see even more little telling signs in the movie that they added with the animation. But yeah, I mean, Encanto is all about the magic, but they present it in such a way that it's not clashing with Disney's brand.
Yeah, there is something about Nightmare, which is sort of about found family in a way, because Halloween Town is a found family. In the books, apparently, in the Long Live Pumpkin Queen books, apparently not only does Jack and Sally have kids, which I have questions about, but Santa becomes a regular visitor to Halloween Town. Like, it's become canon that Santa and Jack are kind of allies and friends in this world where they're both at the top of their respective towns. Now, Tim has said, and Henry has said, and the guy that voiced Jack, not Danny Elfman, the singing voice, but the guy that voices Jack, has said if there were an interesting script, they'd do a potential traditional sequel. But Oogie's Revenge is supposed to be the video game sequel, and of course you've got the Kingdom Hearts stuff. So I would be interested to see what they would do, because now we have like Rise of the Guardians, which was that really great film where Hugh Jackman played the Easter Bunny. So if they did like a pastel, almost Rankin and Bass kind of cutesy Easter Bunny Nightmare Before Easter thing, I would probably watch that. Yeah. I'd probably be amused. A Nightmare Before 4th of July. I don't know if that word, but that's the other. Nightmare Before Thanksgiving is just Halloween. I don't know what the heck else you do with the Thanksgiving door, really.
Yeah, because they did have the trees with the other doors, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They had several, which, by the way, that was the hardest sequence to animate, because they actually had to animate the reflection in the doorknob backwards. Both YouTube and Wikipedia have corroborated that as the most difficult of the animated sequences in the film. Because apparently reflections are hard to do, which I can totally understand.
Oh. Well, then, I'm trying to think if I've got anything else ready to bring. Do you have any other thoughts, good sir?
I love the version I have on Blu-ray that is the sing-along version, where you can choose to make it an event in your own private home. Or make it a big party where you like show it on a wall and everyone comes over and sings. I like the idea you can choose to do it as an intimate thing that you just love. Or you can do it as this really big thing. And unlike Return to Oz, that you kind of have to explain things to, and some of the kids might get really creeped out by, Nightmare is something where you can choose how big your level of participation is, from dressing up for Comic-Con to dyeing Easter eggs to look like Jack and Sally, which I've seen. To like buying stuff from different Etsy shops and buying stickers at Comic-Con too. I think there's something really cool about Nightmare, that it is gothic and creepy, but it is very approachable in a way even Beetlejuice isn't. And I think it's no wonder that it worked when it did, and that it came back. I'm really glad that it wasn't just like a cult sleeper hit that like 10 people know about. I'm really glad that I'm really glad for the cultural phenomenon it is. But that people are protective enough over it that it hasn't oversaturated the market. So I'm very grateful for Nightmare, and I thought it was really important to talk about more of its cultural implications than the film itself. Because the film itself has kind of been talked to death, and there was some cool stuff, but it's more about the culture around it that's really more important than the film itself at this point, which is okay. Yes.
I totally agree. There's a certain timeless element to this film that I think it's gonna last for many, many years in the public's mind beyond this. And I think it is that while it is a Disney property, it sort of goes beyond Disney. It, you know, it stands as its own thing that doesn't need to be associated with Disney at all. I'm sure some of our listeners are going to be surprised to hear that, you know, it was made by Disney and it's always been a Disney property. Because as much as it's included within a lot of the merchandising in the shops and such, it does feel like it's just its own separate thing. And it, I think that it's such a great thing that it's now so owned by so many people that it will just last, and it continue to encourage new creativity and such. And I am truly glad that it's not been franchised to death like so many other things. And the whole thing about franchising everything is maybe a conversation for another day. I would try to make it a conversation rather than a personal rant on wearing out things.
Well, say what you want about franchising and merchandise, but I have a Nightmare Before Christmas Clue set, which is one of my favorite Clue board games. So I'm pretty happy with some of the merchandise. Not all of it, but at least that I'm fairly happy with.
Indeed.
All right.
Well, it's been a pleasure, as
it
always,
has.
Sir.
Next time we'll be talking about a fairly new cultural milestone. I will not say what we're going to be talking about, only that it's a film. And only that we're going to have a lot of fun talking about it, because I think it's a fun and incredibly intimate film, actually. And we'll see you next time on Everything is Gay, Even the Straight Stuff. If you are having American Thanksgiving like I'm having this November, remember to eat, drink responsibly. And if you need to, take a cue from Saturday Night Live and play Adele's Hello, because that will smooth over any family arguments that you have while the wind blows, which is great.
And all I can say is toodles.